Hamiltonien, c'est une politique, mais ça n'est pas le peuple des États-Unis. Le peuple des États-Unis, lui aussi, est victime de ce groupuscule qui s'est emparé du pouvoir chez lui. Il s'en est emparé par la fraude électorale et qui commence maintenant à maltraiter ce peuple comme il a maltraité les autres. Je vais donner la parole à John Anthony, qui a eu le courage de venir ici, et je dis que c'est du courage parce que quand on a une position aussi éminente que la sienne dans son pays, il préside de nombreuses associations politiques et caritatives, il est membre du Council on Foreign Relations, il a participé à toutes sortes d'initiatives de paix au Proche-Orient. Quand on a le courage de venir comme cela, on s'expose. Mais aujourd'hui, il se trouve qu'il y a aussi une résistance qui commence aux États-Unis.
It's nice to hear that some think it's an act of courage to come here. For me, it's not an act of courage. It's natural, it's easy, it's a moral duty, it's a civic obligation, it's a righteous requirement. Talk from an American perspective with regard to the neocons, who are the ones who have been behind the motor driving these policies and positions on the United States. And as I speak with respect to Iraq, I will be building on the previous commentary of several of our predecessors there, but providing additional detail there. Among Americans, it has often been said that President Reagan, amongst others, contributed mightily to the collapse of communism in the USSR without firing a single shot. In contrast, what the United States has done, and of course, bringing about the collapse of Iraq is another matter altogether, as we know all too dramatically. Among some policymakers prior to the invasion and occupation of Iraq, it was obvious that they gave too little thought to the kinds of demons that would be unleashed as a consequence of the invasion and occupation. However, amongst others that were far more critical and crucial and influential in making sure that the invasion and occupation took place, it is my view that they could have cared less, that they were shameless with regard to the demons that would be unleashed. And I will give you my reasons why I come to that particular conclusion. For those who pushed hardest to have the war, what mattered most were, on the one hand, their overriding near-term strategic goals, namely to overthrow the regime and reconfigure the country. And on the other hand, the use of these two achievements to pursue other goals of equal, if not far greater, importance. Only thus, in the minds of these thinkers and planners, could the quest for macro American strategic gain and economic advantage be accomplished. Only thus, they reasoned, could the ground be prepared to achieve additional long-term resource and other material benefits. Among these further goals were the following. One, the placement of American firms in the premier position to influence the policies and decisions regarding future Iraq oil and gas concessions, as well as production. Number two, the goal of not so much weakening the idea of prolonging a nationally sovereign, politically independent, and territorially intact Iraq as practically doing away with it, doing away with such manifestations of the Iraqi people's freedom and their neighborhood, nationhood, and instead the upholding the country's unity, substituting a weak and loosely organized tripartite confederation in its place. Number three, the objective of altering the collective effectiveness of OPEC by taking down one of its founding members. That, as everyone knows, happens to be one of OPEC's two most energy resource-rich members. Number four, the goal of removing the militarily strongest anti-Israeli player from the Israeli-Palestinian and Israeli-Syrian tables. Number five, the goal of depriving the Palestinian resistance, a major source of financial and political support. Number six, the enhancement of Israel's geostrategic and military position in the region. Number seven, the goal of privatizing as much of the Iraqi economy as possible, in such a way that where democratic processes allowed to prevail on this topic, the Iraqi people themselves would likely never agree. And in such a way as to favor American corporate interests and market liberalization schemes popular with the Bush administration's big business factors. Number eight, the related goal of substantially lowering the corporate tax rates on foreign businesses in Iraq in such a way that, again, if the Iraqi people had a choice, they would likely not accept peacefully or democratically. Number nine, the unstated but transparent goal of directly or indirectly installing compliant mini states in place of the previous unified country in such a way that in matters of major importance to U.S. strategic and national security interests, those advisors, American advisors, could be counted on to ensure that serious and favorable consideration would be extended to American firms for contracts for military bases, Armed Forces Command and General Staff Colleges, military education and training, the periodic conducting of military maneuvers and joint exercises, the procurement and security of defense systems, weaponry, ammunition, and the prepositioning of equipment. Number 10, the related goal of positioning a different set of American advisors and consultants within key Iraqi economic infrastructure agencies in such a way as to enable them to direct contracts to U.S. companies that build refineries, build electric power generating plants, build sewage systems, desalination facilities, mega office building complexes and hotels, international airports and shipping terminals, oil storage facilities, and the design, procurement, and construction of oil, gas, and water pipelines, both within Iraq and beyond it. Number 11, the goal of making it more problematic than ever before for the GCC, or the Majlis-e-Da'wah, and the Arab and the Gulf Cooperation Council countries to provide meaningful material support for the Palestinians, lest they found themselves like Tehran and Damascus and the gun sites of the American neocons and the high-ranking supporters in the White House, the Defense Department, and the CIA. Number 12, the furtherance of a sub-regional atmosphere of unease and uncertainty among the six GCC countries in such a way that such uncertainties and apprehensions might make key decision-making segments within these countries increasingly disposed to enter into still additional and costly defense cooperative arrangements with the United States. Number 13, the impetus to induce increasing numbers of the GCC countries to enter into bilateral free trade agreements with the United States, thereby adding a material dimension to the perceived but not yet fully materialized mutuality of benefit, and thereby adding greater strength still to the already strong cement bonding the American imperial power on the one hand to the U.S. GCC protected state structure and pan-Gulf de facto U.S. Arab protectorate status already in place on the other. 14, by no means last or least, the granting to Iraq's soon to be newly constituted regional governments of constitutional authority to negotiate and conclude new oil and gas concessions with foreign companies. In addition to everything else already noted, the constitutional attainment of this last particular goal, which may eventually become the greatest strategic and economic prize for all, was and remains the quintessential prerequisite to enabling American energy companies to enter the country's oil economy in a major way. Of course, it needs to be pointed out that this particular American accomplishment in the form of new Iraqi oil and gas concessions being granted to U.S. companies has not yet come to pass. However, with little difficulty, one can see this happening in the relatively near-term future. If so, it would be hard, on one hand, to imagine a greater strategic gain and economic benefit for those who pushed hard for the war and thus far have gotten away with it. And on the other hand, it would be but one more dramatic illustration of the disintegration of respect for international law and the norms of international legitimacy. for if this major resource gain is secured for American economic benefit, as was the intention and has remained the most important strategic objective from the beginning, it will make it far more difficult than ever before for the Chinese, for the French, and for Russian competitors to access significant new amounts of Iraqi oil. In spite of the fact that each of these three energy-hungry nations hold title in varying degrees to sovereign signed and initial instruments affording them legal access to Iraqi oil, whereas, ironically, the United States as yet does not. If I have correctly enumerated the main goals of those who pushed hard for this war to take place regardless of the cost, it is not difficult to conclude that Bush administration policy-based national intelligence, national attitudes, and national actions won out over policies based on fact-based national intelligence, national attitudes, and national actions. Finally, if I am accurate in one other way, that the damage to the United States and those among its allies who elected to associate themselves in this harmful exercise is largely self-inflicted, not to mention the tragedies visited upon the Iraqi people, then it seems difficult to deny that the reason is rooted in American policies that were strategically unsound, economically wasteful, and morally bankrupt to begin with.